My Classic Album with Mike Norris is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of My Classic Album and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.
Welcome to another edition of My Classic Album, the show where we look back on some of the greatest albums in music history. I'm Mike Norris, and thank you for joining us for another episode of the podcast. We're going to be looking today at one of the biggest albums of the early 80s, Synchronicity by The Police. And my special guest who has chosen the album today is Damon Johnson, who many of you will know from his time in Black Star Riders and Brother Kane. So I grew up as a huge fan of Sting and a huge fan of The Police. It was one of those things that I've said before, kind of when I was a kid and I was raiding my parents' music collection, and they got to a point where I thought, right, well, I want to discover more bands and I want to listen to more music. And my mum and dad would buy me albums, like compilations for Christmas, that they thought I'd enjoy. And one of the ones they bought me one Christmas was The Very Best of Sting and The Police. When Sting moved on from The Police, it was a very different sound to what we'd heard before. And Synchronicity is the perfect album to explore that, because it's almost a bridge between what they were doing with The Police and what Sting would go on to do in his very successful and illustrious solo career. So we'll be talking about that in just a little bit. Speaking about Sting's solo career, both Damon and I have had the opportunity to meet Sting. You'll hear Damon's story later on. And it's funny because I've heard so many people bash Sting in the way that he is with people and stuff. My experience with him was extremely positive. So he released an autobiography about his childhood, maybe about 15 years ago now. I was at university and he was signing books in Newcastle. And I thought, I've got to go. And I was it's funny because I was stood in the queue, and I would argue that I was probably the youngest there by a good 20 years. And people were kind of good naturedly making fun of me and going like, you know, obviously the bookshop was playing Sting songs as it went on, and they were saying things like, oh, well, I bet you don't remember this one. And you know, it was just all fun. When I got to the front, he must have just caught a glance of me out the corner of his eye. And he was really taken aback with the fact that I was this 18-year-old who'd stood in a queue with all these 40-year-olds waiting to have this book signed. And he said to me, how old are you? And I was like, oh, I'm 18. And he was like, oh, so young people still listen to my music then? Which I thought was quite a funny thing to say. And I was like, well, yeah, I do. You and I've always loved your music. He said, what's your name? And I said, my name's Mike. And I still have the book to this day because he wrote "To Mike" from Sting, put a nice smiley face in it. And it was just a short interaction, but for me, it's always one I've looked back on really fondly. And a few years later, fans of Sting may remember that he did a concert in Durham Cathedral to promote the release of his album at the time, If on a Winter's Night. And it was full of kind of Christmas carols and medieval songs of winter, peppered with kind of some of his own songs that were about winter. And if I remember rightly, I think the actual performance that you saw on TV and what's now on DVD, I believe that was for like members of his fan club only, or it was kind of like exclusive access. But they did a dress rehearsal the night before. And my dad, who at the time worked for Durham Police, and he was heavily involved in the liaison between the production company and Durham City into kind of getting this project to run successfully with, you know, as without a hitch, and to make sure that Sting had everything that he needed and all that kind of thing. And obviously regular listeners will know that I live literally about 5 minutes from Durham City Centre, and I did at the time. And my dad just rang me out of the blue and he'd said, what are you doing tonight? And I said, oh, nothing. Why? He says, well, Sting's doing a dress rehearsal of his performance. Do you want to come? I was like, yes, Absolutely. So I've only ever seen Sting perform once, but it was in Durham Cathedral, and he performed these songs from his new album at the time, If on a Winter's Night. And for me, I love Durham Cathedral. I think most people who live in Durham do. And it was just a wonderful memory for me to hear Sting performing these songs. And it was essentially what you saw from the performance on TV, but without all the cameras there. They were calling it a dress rehearsal. And what I loved about it as well is that he'd been performing all these songs, but he also performed, which I believe he did on the final performance as well, he performed Ghost Story from Brand New Day, which is one of my favourite Sting songs. So to hear one of my favourite songs ever, let alone a song by him, performed in such a beautiful setting acoustically and aesthetically, is just a memory that I'll never forget. One of the greatest live music experiences I could ever have wished to have had. So that's just kind of my history with Sting's music and how much I love him. So to chat with Damon about The Police and this really pivotal moment in Sting's career where he went from a member of a band to starting on the road to become this international superstar, it's a really interesting path. And that's not to take away from Andy and Stuart, who this album, it's a phenomenal album, and it's because of the three of them. You know, Damon and I do talk a lot about how awesome Sting is, but Stuart and Andy are too. Just phenomenal musicians, phenomenal band. Before we get into Synchronicity, I just wanted to touch briefly. He's just released a compilation of re-recordings, reimaginings of some of his biggest hits with The Police and his solo career called My Songs. And it's interesting because some people have been a little skeptical about it. You know, he's done similar things in the past. I think he released an album called Symphonicities where he had them backed with an orchestra, and he's released a few live collections. All This Time, as I recall, that it was recorded on the night of the 9/11 attacks. I've got that on CD somewhere, and there's some really quite haunting versions of some of his greatest hits. But this is a new one where he said he's given them a contemporary feel. And I think it's interesting that, you know, as I've said, I'm a huge Sting fan, but when you do a podcast like this, the opportunity to go back and listen to people that you love or to discover new music is just there, totally. So because Damon chose an album by The Police and because I've been a fan of theirs and Sting's for a long time, it just seems real circumstance that Sting would release an album with these songs on. And I decided I was going to have a listen to them and just kind of see if I agreed with him that he'd put this kind of contemporary feel on them. The first one that I listened to, I didn't actually listen to the album in full straight away. He did release a few songs from it bit by bit. And the first song that I heard was his new version of Every Breath You Take, which of course is on Synchronicity, that we're going to be discussing very shortly. And I'd thought to myself, I didn't really feel like he'd done much with it. I was going to listen to the song and I was thinking, well, you know, it's a great song. You know, we're going to talk about it in depth in just a little bit as to why it's so great. But he hadn't done much to it in terms of changing it. I think Damon and I hit the nail on the head. In some ways, that song is such a perfect song. We'll talk about the struggle of that song being recorded. Perhaps it didn't need to be redesigned. We don't need to reinvent the wheel on certain songs. It's just an up-to-date recording of it. But then there are other songs on the album where he has had a bit of a play around with it with varying degrees of success. So, you know, If You Love Someone, Set Them Free almost sounds like a dance remix of like something you'd hear in a club or something. It's not hugely kind of dance orientated, but it does have very much of a remix kind of vibe. It does feel quite different. And in some ways it does work. But if you love the original song, and I feel like this for the whole album, like, you know, the first two tracks on the album are from Brand New Day, which is my favourite Sting album. So there's the title track and then Desert Rose. And I listened to them and I enjoyed what he'd done with them, but, and perhaps this is the intention, it made me want to go back and listen to the original tracks. It made me want to go back into Sting's back catalogue and listen to all of these songs. You know, it was like, yeah, he's got a nice flavour on that. I see what he's done there. Some of them he has put a contemporary spin on. Some of them he's tried to stick as close to the original source recording as he can. But the feeling you get from all of them is you think, these are great songs. You know, he's a fantastic songwriter. And it made me just want to go back and listen to the originals. And I don't mean that a detriment to the newly recorded ones. It just reminded me why I love Sting so much. And in that sense, the album's a success. So My Songs is out now. And, you know, I don't feel like he's reinvented the wheel particularly. But if you love those songs, there's something there definitely for you to check them out. And I think you'll find, like me, it'll make you go back into your music collection and pull out those albums like Brand New Day or Ten Summoner's Tales or The Police albums, Synchronicity, and listen to the original songs, you know. And I think surely that's what it's all about. So I've rambled on for long enough. My special guest today is Damon Johnson, and he has chosen The Police's fifth and final studio album, Synchronicity, as his classic album. But before we get to my chat with Damon, let's just have a look at the facts. Here's the beginning of what you need to know about Synchronicity. Synchronicity is the fifth studio album from Anglo-American rock band The Police. Produced by the band with Hugh Padgham, the album was released through A&M Records on the 17th of June, 1983. Synchronicity would prove to be the final studio album from The Police due to the deteriorating relationships within the band, issues that would cause many problems during production. Each member recorded their contributions in a separate room of AIR Studios in Montserrat, which, while ensuring tensions didn't boil over, also contributed to the great sound exhibited on the album. Lead single Every Breath You Take was not only a huge hit for the band, but arguably the defining song of their and indeed Sting's career. The song reached number one on both sides of the Atlantic, and has become one of the most loved and well-known songs in modern music history. While not as successful as Every Breath You Take, the other singles on Synchronicity had great chart success. Wrapped Around Your Finger reached number 7 on the UK Singles Chart and number 8 on the Billboard Hot 100 in the US. Both Synchronicity 2 and King of Pain reached number 17 in the UK, while charting strongly in the United States. The album proved to be the most successful for The Police in a career full of classic albums. Synchronicity reached number 1 all over the world in countries including the UK, US, Italy and Australia. With sales of over 8 million in the US alone, the album is certified 8 times platinum there, as well as platinum certification in the United Kingdom. The success of Synchronicity and its legacy as the band's final album has caused it to be heavily regarded by many as a true classic. Synchronicity was voted 13th by BBC Radio 2 listeners in their Top 100 Favourite Albums poll in 2013. In the 2003 edition of Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Albums of All Time, Synchronicity was placed at number 455, but when the publication updated their list in 2012, the album was actually slightly higher, at number 448. So, that's just the beginning of what we need to know about Synchronicity, and I have here with me my very special guest, who chose the album to talk about today. This is Damon Johnson. How's it going?
Really well, Mike. Thank you for having me on. We're going to talk about, obviously, a very influential album today for many of us, and certainly one that was very, very successful on the charts.
Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't agree more. Before we get too deep into it, why have you chosen Synchronicity to talk about today on My Classic Album?
I chose Synchronicity because at the place I'm at in my career now more than ever, I really am channeled into some of the songwriters that have influenced me so much over the last 30 years of the time I have spent as a songwriter, attempting to improve as a songwriter. And, you know, just in recent years, I've revisited several of the artists that I've always felt kind of set me on my path in the beginning. And I think sometimes some of the older albums, and certainly some an artist like Sting that has been around for so long, I think it's easy to take them for granted. There's so much noise out there, so much music that we all get bombarded with. I've just been in this period of reflection on some of the all-time greats, you know, Dylan, Tom Petty, for us Americans, you know, even a songwriter like Bob Seger, just written incredible songs, a career of that. Country writers like Merle Haggard, and of course, Hank Williams, Willie Nelson. But Sting and The Police just occupy a lot of real estate for me and my wife. We're just there. I think The Police were the first band that we talked about having in common when we first met over 20 years ago. Certainly Synchronicity as an album holds a special place for me.
And what are your memories of hearing it for the first time? Was that when the album came out, or did you kind of come across it later?
No, I remember it distinctly when it first came out. I guess that year would have been 83. Is that correct, Mike?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, man, I was fresh out of high school. I was in my first year of college. And, you know, MTV was in a way still kind of a newer entity. I grew up in a really rural area of Alabama. So MTV was like really high class stuff for us. Not everyone had cable television, you know, so everyone didn't have MTV. And I remember my drummer, Michael was his name, Michael Rawlings. He played drums in my little garage band, and his parents had cable. So we would go to Michael's house and watch MTV. And And I was already a fan of the Police, but you know, they had just dropped Synchronicity, and the first single was Every Breath You Take. And I don't know, you probably have more statistics there in front of you, but Every Breath You Take went on to be arguably one of the most played songs in the history of radio. You know what I mean? Not just in the history of rock music or pop music, in the history of radio, period. You know, it's like, wow. So I just remember hearing Every Breath You Take the first time and thinking, how does he do it? How does he write a song that is so simple and so memorable melodically that I could just, after seeing it and hearing it on the television, and I could almost sing the whole thing in my head already after one listen. Just a seminal individual single. And then, of course, you know, I went out and bought the whole album and was just overcome with kind of the depth of tempos, you know, lyrical content. You know, I mean, it's certainly, I don't think it was a perfect album, Mike. There's some moments that I guess are what some people might call filler. I listened to that album so much that I came to love those songs every bit as much as I did, you know, the hit singles and the more popular stuff. So, you know, between hearing it, buying the album, I think I bought it on cassette tape first. The album was accompanied by that iconic imagery of the color swashes, you know, the yellow, the red, the blue. It was almost Warhol-esque in its impression, the impact it made culturally. You know, Synchronicity was just a body of work in every way. I don't know how many albums you can describe like that. Certainly that time period with the advent of MTV, many artists were incorporating art and fashion into their music as well. So Synchronicity was just kind of the album and the music and the images that easily occupied very, very much of 1983 and 1984.
And it's funny you should be talking about MTV and kind of the role of the Police in that movement, I guess. We all know now, of course, Sting had this hugely successful solo career afterwards, but I think it's really important to kind of preface what we're talking about by reminding everyone just how huge the Police were in the early 80s. So we're talking 1983, Synchronicity's released in the summer. 1983, we're talking about the album charts being dominated by Michael Jackson's Thriller. So that's the best-selling album of all time. Yet the Police were able to rack up 17 non-consecutive weeks at the top of the Billboard charts throughout 1983 with Synchronicity. So in this kind of wall of noise that was essentially just Thriller, 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 there was Synchronicity there as well. And I think that's just a small measure of how big the Police were at this point.
What an incredible statistic. I wasn't aware of that. I mean, when you put it into that context, that's massive, but that's monumental that they were able to occupy the top of the charts for 17 weeks in that time period. My one sadness from that year, Mike, is that I did not get to see the Police. I was out of town when they came through, you know, my area. They played in Birmingham, Alabama, which is where we would go see concerts. I was out of town and wasn't able to go. And I just thought, well, I'll catch it at some other city. And it just never happened, of course, because the band broke up after that album.
And I think what's really notable about Synchronicity is that, as you touched upon with you saying that you weren't able to catch them when they came to your neck of the woods, Synchronicity was the final studio album by the Police. And we'll talk a lot more about the reasons why and the circumstances around that as we go. In their review of the album back in 1983, Rolling Stone summed up the themes of the album by suggesting that Synchronicity is an album about things ending. Would you agree with that idea, that the album deals with kind of endings and that kind of thing, while the band themselves were heading towards the end of their time as a band?
That's a great question. I guess it's slightly affected by the knowledge afterwards that they did indeed, you know, call it quits and Sting went on to pursue a solo career. I do know that the images that Sting created lyrically of what I view just relationship songs, songs like Wrapped Around Your Finger, King of Pain, you know, it was very kind of self-loathing. It would have never occurred to me to think that he was writing about it in the context of, wow, I'm the king of pain. I just thought it was, you know, a relationship with a partner. But eloquently, you know, those lyrics can now obviously be applied to his relationship with Andy and Stuart. Wow. Yeah. I guess there's no way to view it really. You certainly can't deny the themes of moving on to, you know, the turmoil within the band. Yeah. Maybe that is why the record has such staying power. Again, you cannot undervalue how huge those singles were. You can speak more to how well it did over there, Mike, in the UK and in Europe. But here in America, I guess there were 5 singles. It was very Michael Jackson-esque when you realize there were that many songs that were hits off of just one album. Wow.
So producer Hugh Padgham spoke to Sound on Sound a few years back, and he confessed that band relations were so bad that the album was actually one meeting away from not happening. And I'll tell that story a little later on. I've got a quote from Hugh. He says, "They were sick of each other. Sting and Stuart hated each other. And although Andy didn't show as much venom, he could be quite grumpy. And there were both verbal and physical fights in the studio. So this really is the definition of a band who could barely be in the same room together." And I can think of myself kind of this, the video footage they show of just like Stuart and Sting just getting into like a scrap in the middle of an interview and all that sort of stuff. You can just say how difficult that relationship was at that point.
Yes. You know, I can't imagine that that would be very much fun. You know, it's like, speaking as someone who has spent his musical career in bands and relationships with the other members within the band, you know, obviously you're going to have disagreements from time to time and things that you argue over, but you know, nothing that ever escalated to anything physical like that. You know, being on the road is so hard anyway, Mike. There's so many challenges of just your own kind of sense of keeping healthy and being on time and having your performance prepared, you know, like keeping your chops up on your instrument or vocally or whatever you're doing, man. It's just so much that you have to maintain. So to add on top of that, someone you're touring the world with that you just really don't like and you don't like to be around, that's just has to be painful, literally painful. I don't care how much money you're making. And obviously they were making millions and millions of dollars at that point. It couldn't have been an easy decision for Sting to pull the plug. But then, you know, when you think about it in the way that we're discussing right now, maybe it wasn't that hard. Maybe he was like, look, we've done it all. We've gone to the top. Every album we've ever put out is platinum plus. We're the biggest band in the world right now. There's nowhere else to go. So why do I want to continue to try and be creative and productive inside this energy? You know, time to move on.
Yeah, absolutely. And Stuart Copeland actually chatted with Sound Vapors last year when they were talking about the 35th anniversary of Synchronicity. And he gave a bit of insight as to where these disagreements with Sting came from. So he said it was really important to each of the three of us that it was right. We cared about it and there were no passengers in the place. There was nobody to say, yeah, sure, if you guys like it, sure, that's fine. When you're young, you subscribe to the notion that there is only one musical truth, mine. So how difficult is that in a studio environment when you're so sure that that musical truth is yours, you're so sure that what you're thinking is the way forward, and then there's someone else who's just as talented, who is just as huge a part of the band, who has that exact same belief about their own musical truth?
Well, I think that just the word respect is very vital in that relationship. You know, the example that is at the forefront of my mind, the closest to me, is the time that I spent in Black Star Riders, especially working with Ricky Warwick. Ricky is such a talented songwriter, full of ideas, full of, you know, commitment and energy and just extraordinary. And he has such an output of songs. I think sometimes it was hard for the other guys in the band to keep up. And I guess because I had spent so many years as a frontman myself and writing the bulk of the material, it felt very familiar to me to move at that pace. So there's no doubt there were times, either in the writing setting or in the recording setting, where we would have different ideas. You know, he would think the song should shift here, and I would say, no, let's wait. We never lost respect for each other ever in those conversations. There were definitely times that we kind of had to fight for, you know, verbally express ourselves to say, hey, listen, just give this idea a chance, please, because I really believe, you know, It will be great. Just try it. Let's try it. And to his credit, he would always try it, as I would try to do, you know, for him. And then, you know, you kind of assess the energy in the room, what maybe some of the other people around are feeling, or, you know, and then you move on. I just think, you know, Ricky for sure has been in some other band settings where it was difficult. And I know he has said to me many times, that's one of the joys for him of Black Star Riders, is that, you know, he's kind of earned that position as leader, and people really respect his opinion about those things. But he always treated everyone respectfully. Great. You know, wanted to know what everybody thought about things, but he had no problem saying, hey, I've taken all this on board. I still feel like this is the way to go. Not one fist was ever thrown or even clenched. You know what I mean? It's because we're mates and we're all mates, and, you know, you have that respect. It really sounds like the police at that point had lost all respect for each other, certainly Sting and Stewart. And, you know, if you think about it, Mike, those guys, you know, they'd been kind of going at each other right from the beginning. You know, Stewart was the one that started the police. It was his band. And I think he kind of fancied it to be sort of the platform for him to express his songwriting and that kind of thing. And quickly, if you're a student of their history as I am, you know, Sting carved out his position immediately as, hang on, your songs are good, my songs are great. You know, it's very, very hard to argue with the difference in quality of Sting's songs compared to everyone else. Just, I mean, even if you just play it on an acoustic guitar, they're kind of perfect. All of them. It's like, it's incredible the craft that Sting has achieved and how many times he's been able to do it time and time again. It's extraordinary. There just aren't that many songwriters on certainly in pop music that have that success rate that he has. And, you know, look no further than Synchronicity for shining examples of that.
So partly due to the working relationship with the band at the time, the decision was made for each member to record their contributions in separate rooms. So Andy Summers was in the actual studio at AIR Studios in Montserrat. Sting was in the control room, which I think says a lot about the dynamic of the band at the time. While Paul Stewart and his drum set were actually in a dining room in an adjacent building upstairs, and he communicated with them via a video link. So Hugh said that this was due to social reasons, and from a production, God. I know, and from a production perspective, it helped him to get the best sound out of each instrument. Do you think that shines through on Synchronicity? Do you think that Stewart's drums stand out despite him being relegated to the dining room?
No, listen, man, I think there is no question that's a bonus fulfillment that we all get from that album beyond the quality of the songwriting and the performances, just the sounds, the sonic template that they used to record that album. You know, Hugh was the producer. I forget who did most of the engineering on that record, but man, the sound, there's a timeless nature to it. It doesn't sound dated as so many albums did from the time period. I would argue that. I'm sure some people might disagree, but I you know, just the way it sounded, and maybe that had something to do with it, the fact that they were in separate rooms like that. As we have our discussion, Mike, I just cannot get over what it must have been like, that environment, to try and make music together, and you just want to claw each other's eyeballs out. You know, it's just, it had to be really, really difficult. Very tough.
Absolutely. And I mean, creatively, and we've touched on this a lot already, I think Synchronicity is a very ambitious, in some places, quite a daring album. And we've talked a lot about the relationships within the band during the production of the album. But in some ways, that really informs the music on it. So earlier this year, Laurie Garver over at excessnoise.com gave her take on the album. And she said, Synchronicity delved into many archetypal struggles that mankind has faced for an eon, but it was also about the breakdown of relationships. And of course, I think once we get to side two, that becomes even more apparent. Sting and Andy Summers' marriages were ending during the recording, and the aftermath of that emotional turmoil seeps into many tracks, along with the band's struggles to get along with each other. So for me, personally, there's almost a parallel to an album like Rumours by Fleetwood Mac, that there were these kind of life events happening in struggles. They can't not have an effect on the music that you produce, and I think that both Synchronicity and Rumours prove that.
I agree 100%. And I think there's no question that great art comes from great challenges in any of our personal lives. You know, if I could be so narcissistic, you know, as I reflect over a handful of songs just from my own career as a songwriter, there's no doubt that the ones that rise to the top in my fulfillment and my enjoyment of listening to the songs, you know, later, it's always the ones that came from, you know, a real event. And you know, they can almost be like therapy in a way, Mike. You know, songwriting and recording, it kind of helps us work out problems in our own life. You know, you wish you could bottle that. I guess in a way you wish you could just drink a bottle of turmoil. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Let me take a glass of disaster, go away for a week, write some songs, and then we'll go right into the studio, guys, and it'll be great. I would rather live my life without the turmoil, but man, for inspired, compelling songwriting, for sure.
And, you know, like Rumours, Synchronicity, as we've said, has a crazy amount of hit singles. You hear things such as how the album, by name and concept, was inspired by Carl Jung's theory of synchronicity, which we'll touch on in a bit. And it all sounds quite daunting. We'll talk about some of the things that inspired Sting to write some of his songs. And it's very much like, whoa, that's really deep. But underneath the ambitious production and these world music influences that creep in, there is a very human side to this album, which is possibly why it was such a success and why people keep coming back to it 36 years on. We're sitting talking about this album. And a lot of it is to do with that human side, that turmoil that's created such a fascinating album that we return to again and again.
Yes, and I just had the thought, as a fan, longtime fan of Sting, you know, a huge component of his discipline as a songwriter just comes from upbringing in Newcastle, the working class environment of the shipyards. I believe his father ran a milk route, you know, so always punctual, always on time, cup of tea, guitar in hand, go to work. I think he lives his life that exact same way to this day. To be that disciplined as an artist and as a writer, and then achieve the monumental success that some of the earlier songs did, Message in a Bottle, Roxanne, Every Little Thing She Does Is Magic, for him to have this output of quality songs in the most difficult of settings with those relationships. I love those songs so much from Synchronicity, and I studied them and I will continue to study them in my own career. But this discussion we've had today is really fantastic. And, you know, when you really put a microscope on the internal relationships within the band and then recognize that this was the result of that time they spent in the studio, it's just even more extraordinary. There's no doubt I'm going to play the album tonight and talk about it with my wife.
Well, it's funny. Obviously, we're preparing for this. I've been listening to it all day. If you don't mind, I was going to go track by track, if you're happy to go into it a bit further.
Yes, absolutely.
So we'll start with Synchronicity 1. So Synchronicity 1, like many tracks on the album, is notable for its use of synthesizers, something which at the time was a departure from that established sound of The Police. How does Synchronicity 1 open the album for you? And does it feel like a big departure from that previous kind of reggae-inspired sound that they had on previous albums?
You yourself said earlier, world music, you know, world music influence and world music sounds. I felt like that was front and center on Synchronicity 1. That keyboard line, they almost sounds like bell chimes, you know, that is playing the main theme that kind of goes through the whole song, but it's with that punk rock tempo, you know, that Stewart always was. I always felt like Stewart Copeland was always striving for energy and tempo. And I know that was part of the struggle between he and Sting through all their years together. Stewart wanted to rock out. He wanted the songs to move. He wasn't concerned with the clinking jewelry, older crowd. You know, he wanted to rock and see the kids moving in the crowd, and Synchronicity 1 achieved that in spades. So just the perfect song to start the album.
So the lyrics of Synchronicity 1 and 2, which comes later in the album, are inspired by the works of Arthur Koestler and psychologist Carl Jung's theory of synchronicity, which states, I've tried to find the best definition of it that I can, that coincidental events are connected through their meaning. So that's quite deep stuff. Sting once said about the song, and indeed the album's theme of synchronicity, "Is there any meaning in coincidence? That's what I wanted this record to be about. It's a grand design. I'm not sure if it'll come off or not." Do you think that he succeeds in that regard? Do you think that the songs do tell that story and explain that theory of synchronicity?
Well, I think the proof of the answer being the affirmative is the fact that we're talking about it all these years later, and there's this connection between those songs and what ultimately happened to the band and the lasting impact of them. I think it would be difficult to argue that he didn't achieve that, because I do think he did. I think he did. I mean, there's such a connection between real life, certainly those personalities, and then, you know, they produce this album and release it, and it connects with all of us. It connects with people all over the world in their own living and in their own connectivity to the world, to events, to their families, to themselves. Indeed, heady stuff, but yeah, I think he pulled it off.
So we've talked a bit already about Stewart's performance on this track. David Weiss at Sonic Scoop cites the track as an example of Stewart's genius ability, as he calls it. He says, "I tell all my friends this, try listening to Synchronicity 1, and for the entire 3 minutes 23, don't take your ears off the drums. Just position the drum track front and centre in your mind and hold it right there." Would you agree, is this the best example, perhaps of their entire career, of just how great a drummer Stewart is? I know you said that there was a part of him that really just wanted to rock out and, like, just let go of all the inhibitions and just go for it.
Yes. The answer is yes. There are many songs that you could play, but I don't know that there's a better one. You know, he still gets in his kind of jazz fusion background, some of that musicality, this just polyrhythms and just extraordinary musicianship he has as a drummer. I think all of that kind of makes an appearance in that one song. But again, the tempo, it's just driving. The article you just mentioned, I mean, that would be a great experience that I'll attempt to do myself. Just, you know, put it on the headphones and just focus on the drums. I mean, it's got to be physically exhausting to, you know, try to perform at that level. Stewart would probably tell us both right now that he can't play it like that anymore, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you should say that, because I have got a quote from him here when he's talking about the song, and he says, "It was real Ramalama way of starting our set on tour." So obviously they opened with it on the Synchronicity tour. "Though it almost killed me to start with that kind of onslaught every night." So as you say, it must have been exhausting to have to replicate that performance night after night during the Synchronicity tour.
Had to be tough. Had to be very, very tough.
But I guess if anyone could do it.
You know, well, and they were definitely in shape for it, because they just lived on the road, man, over the course of those 5 albums, 6 albums, relentless touring. They were young men then. Stewart was a fit young drummer, and I just wish I could have seen them back then, Mike. I'm sure it was grand.
And that's Damon Johnson there chatting with me about Synchronicity by The Police, and we're going to continue to go track by track in just a little bit. I would love to know your thoughts on our conversation so far. I'd love to know your thoughts on Synchronicity, on Damon and I's interpretation of the album. Get yourself onto our social media pages. Facebook, search for My Classic Album with Mike Norris and like the page. Get yourself on Instagram at My Classic Album Podcast, or you could follow us on Twitter at MCA_podcast. And all of this information and all the latest news that you could possibly need about My Classic Album is over at www.myclassicalbum.co.uk. Coming up, is Tea in the Sahara or Murder by Numbers the true ending to Synchronicity? And just how do Damon and I feel about Andy's songwriting contribution to the album? Is that my mother on the phone? All that and more, right after this. Enjoying this episode of My Classic Album? Don't forget there are loads of amazing albums covered in our previous episodes as part of Season 1, with guests including Guns N' Roses keyboardist Dizzy Reed.
If I had to pick one like favorite band, or I guess a band that was the biggest influence on me, I would go with the Rolling Stones.
Blues guitarist Big Boy Blota.
It sounded great then and it sounded great now. It just seems to have stood the test of time with me anyway. So yeah, it's a real classic for me.
And Nathan Stevens Griffin of Martha.
It's a great song musically, you're absolutely right. It's a banger. Mm-hmm. It is like absolutely a barnstormer of an album opener. Like,
yeah.
Also, there's our anniversary episodes. such as 40 Years of Rumours with Fleetwood Mac, including an interview with engineer Ken Kelly.
Within about 15 minutes, the band was fighting. I've seen, you know, Crosby, Stills, and Nash fight. I've seen Kenny Loggins and Jim Messina fight, but this was a weird. I've never seen couples fight.
And 40 Years of Bat Out of Hell, including an interview with the voice of Paradise by the Dashboard Light, Ellen Foley.
Time is sometimes tricky. Sometimes things seem like very long ago in another life, which it is, but it all, the memories of it and certainly the song itself is always sort of alive in my mind.
All these episodes and more are available at www.myclassicalbum.co.uk and on Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. So we'll move on to Walking in Your Footsteps. So it lyrically draws parallels between the extinction of the dinosaurs and what was then the very real perceived threat of nuclear war, wiping out the human race, which I guess at the time in 1983... and maybe to an extent modern day with things that have happened in recent years, was a genuine huge concern with what was happening on the world stage.
Yeah, Sting has never shied away from addressing those issues. He certainly continued to do that in his solo work. Walking in Your Footsteps, again, kind of a world music song, very tribal. And I confess that as a young man, I was sort of waiting on the song to lift into like some more bombast, you know, some more power chords at some point. But I came to appreciate later that that was not the message. I don't know. I would like to think that that is the songwriting component of Sting's that ultimately came to influence me the most. You know, sometimes it's the things you don't say or the volume that you don't reach in trying to get your idea across that can make the greatest impact. So. Very tribal. I know my oldest daughter, Heather, when she was a baby, she was born in 87. So I was still obsessed with Synchronicity. So she heard that album a lot when she was a child. And Walking in Your Footsteps was hands down her favorite because it just reminded her of dinosaurs. Like the whole idea of these giant creatures walking through the jungle or through the forest and, yeah, just what a unique song. What a bizarre concept and certainly a very instructive lyric that Sting came up with there.
And, you know, we've talked a bit there about the elements of world music creeping in. And I mean, like you said, your daughter likes this one. I personally really like it too. I think it is very catchy. And as a fan of Sting's solo career, and I've followed that for a long time, I think it's a great example of, and I'm going to touch on this more as we go on, you may agree or disagree with me. I feel like that this album, in some ways, is a bridge between what Sting was doing with The Police and what he would go on to do on his own. There's certain tracks on here that I feel like wouldn't feel entirely out of place on a Sting solo album. And this is the first example of that on the album, I think, that we hear.
That's a great point, Mike. Walking in Your Footsteps would have absolutely fit on Dream of the Blue Turtles. No question about it. You know, it did. It had a world sound to it beyond giving any care as to like radio or any of that kind of stuff. You know, he didn't have to anymore. Again, just so bold to choose to address lyrically the heady themes that he really always has, but to just continue to do that and do it so well, it's remarkable.
So I like to kind of pepper this every now and again with a little bit of criticism just to kind of get your perspective on it. And obviously some people see where they're coming from, some people disagree. So Consequence of Sound single Walking in Your Footsteps out for criticism, saying it smells of dank cheese, especially with the dinosaur imagery. Do you think that the dinosaur imagery is maybe a little on the nose, or do you think that it kind of fits with the song? I guess from what we're saying that maybe you think that it's quite a unique song in the message that it's giving out.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, what is he supposed to write about? You know, to me, I always felt like he would set the bar so high on every album to aspire to address things that no one else is talking about. I mean, think about his contemporaries at that time. If it was Peter Gabriel, Elvis Costello, great, great songwriters in their own right. They were all doing magnificent work then, just on a competitive level, not with each other, but just on the charts and, you know, promotion from your record company and all that kind of stuff. Just takes a lot of balls, man, to be like, yeah, guys, I've written this song talking about the dinosaurs and the onset of of climate change, possible nuclear war, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, can you imagine what Andy and Stuart thought?
Well, yeah.
You know, he said, here, guys, I wrote this song. You know, it's one thing if you come in with, you know, the boys are back in town, or, hey, I've written where the streets have no name, you know, whatever. And I can just, I'm sure that fueled Stuart's frustration. It's like, who the hell does this guy think he is bringing in a song like this? We're the biggest band in the world. You want us to record a song about dinosaurs? What's wrong with you, man?
So we'll move on to Oh My God. So in some ways, and I mean, in a lot of ways, the album is kind of Sting's moment. In some ways, Oh My God feels like a very much a Sting moment. Bearing in mind, of course, that our next two tracks are the only two on the album that aren't written by him. And we'll get to those in a minute. Classic Rock Review says the following about Oh My God. The song is a real showcase for Sting with the bass, the anguished lyrics and voice, and the outro saxophone solo above an improvised sounding ending. So I feel like Sting's bass playing is particularly strong on this one, and obviously it's very present in the mix. It seems like a good opportunity to touch on Sting the bass player as opposed to Sting the singer. And I think that maybe a lot of people forget his abilities on the bass sometimes.
There's no question. I mean, the guy's musicality is top shelf, and I do think his bass playing, as we say now these days, you know, I think people sleep on Sting's bass playing often. They just forget. You know, he's not a technically flashy bass player, but always playing for the song and the, you know, just the right dynamic. Oh My God certainly has that. I do think that, I mean, for me, you know, when I listen to Oh My God, I still hear some of those kind of old R&B and soul singer influences on him. You know, he's right up in the upper register from the start of the song. And, you know, when it goes into the chorus and that saxophone line comes in, it could almost be like a higher pitched Bill Withers, or, you know, maybe even a little Smokey Robinson, that kind of thing. I just thought it was soulful in its own way, you know. Not one of the four or five best songs on the record, but perfectly positioned, you know, kind of setting up some of the stuff that would come after it.
So we've talked about the bass. Obviously, the saxophone features quite prominently in a lot of Sting's solo work. Englishman in New York immediately springs to mind for me. But on his solo work, it wasn't Sting on saxophone. However, throughout Oh My God and a few tracks on Ghost in the Machine, the previous album, Sting is the man on the sax. How do you rate Sting's ability on the saxophone, particularly on Oh My God?
You know what? That's a tough one. You know what I mean? It's like, I guess the fact that I don't rate it says a lot, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like I don't listen to those saxophone performances on kind of their note value as much as I listen to what the energy of it brings to the songs. You know, maybe that was part of Sting's own version of punk rock. You know, he's like, look, I'm not this flashy instrumentalist on this instrument, but I can still bring passion and, you know, kind of this explosion of sound to this song because I'm trying to get this idea across, and this choice of notes and the way I'm attacking it, it fits in with the narrative, you know, that I'm trying to get across. I forget sometimes that that's him playing the saxophone, to tell you the truth. That's interesting that we're talking about that again. When I listened to the album this week in advance of our interview, but I can't wait to listen to it again because you're really sharing some fantastic minutia, you know, that I haven't thought about or I wasn't familiar with. So I can't wait to listen to it again.
Awesome. Now, interestingly, and this is probably my favorite thing about this song, it's one of three songs throughout Sting's career that makes use of a particular set of lyrics. And the other two songs that use these lyrics are two of my favorite songs that he wrote. So the lyrics are, and they're at the end of Oh My God, and in fact, I think the end of all three of the songs. Do I have to tell the story of 1,000 rainy days since we first met? It's a big enough umbrella, but it's always me that ends up getting wet. These first appeared on Every Little Thing She Does Is Magic, back on their previous album Ghost in the Machine, and it would later also appear on Sting's solo track 7 Days from his album 10 Summoner's Tales. Do you have an interpretation of those lyrics? I think they must resonate particularly strongly with Sting for him to use them so frequently.
You know, I've often thought that those words, I want to believe that they're a message to his wife, Trudy, that there's something in, you know, the words, maybe the umbrella, you know what I mean? You know, I've just always imagined that it's describing a scene in their relationship, maybe when they first started seeing each other. Who knows? There has to be some connection to her with that passage. I believe that it's even shown up on even more songs than just 7 days. He's cheeky like that, you know? I mean, you know, he's writing all the songs. They're his songs. He can say it whenever he wants. But that's what I've always thought, is that it's some kind of reference to Trudy.
So we're going to move on to, without a doubt, one of the craziest songs I've heard in my entire life. and arguably the craziest song that we've ever tackled on My Classic Album. And that's not to say that it's a bad song. I'm going to preface that. And that's Mother. So if you've never listened to The Police beyond the hits and you're listening to this, just brace yourself in before you put this one on. So it was written by guitarist Andy Summers. It's his only songwriting credit on the album, and he handles lead vocals on the song. It's a track that certainly divides fans. Before we get into what makes it so crazy in both sides of it, what are your thoughts on this song?
It was just this explosion of aggression. You know, for me, I drew a bit of a parallel between Andy's song Mother and Roger Waters' Mother on the Wall. But it's like Andy took it to this really angry, aggressive place. You know, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that when I listen to the album, that I listen to Mother in its entirety. There have been times, Mike, that I have skipped it. But, you know, I've listened to it enough to value what it is on its own merit. Again, man, it's still kind of snotty of those guys to throw a song like that on an album in the middle of these other just landmark songwriting events like King of Pain and Wrapped Around Your Finger. It just makes me laugh. I just laugh at it oftentimes because I just go, wow, how awesome is Andy Summers to write something like that? And again, the whole kind of atmosphere around our discussion, Mike, is, you know, the turmoil within the band in the making of this record. This would be their swan song. This would be it. When Andy walks in and goes, hey guys, I got this cool song. Check it out. It's called Mother. Let me play it for you. Oh my god, I
feel like anyone who's not heard this song is probably like, I need to go and listen to Synchronicity now. I need to pause this podcast and go and listen to this song, because I feel like
I couldn't agree more. If please, anyone that's listening, pause the podcast, go listen to the song, and then come back, and then you'll have a greater appreciation for what we're saying. There's that tone before that kind of atonal guitar solo. There's the tone his voice took when he says Mother. You know, I started talking to my own mother that way to be funny, you know, like I would see my mom and she would, you know, give me some task, or she would be talking gossipy about, you know, someone else, and I would just look at her and go, you know, lower my chin and go, Mother. She's like, what is that? I'm like, forget about it. You wouldn't understand.
So thankfully, Andy actually explained his influences for this song to Song Facts a few years ago. He said, we all have our family situations, and I had a pretty intense mother who was very focused on me. I was sort of the golden child, and there I was, sort of fulfilling all of her hopes and dreams by being this pop star in The Police. I got a certain amount of pressure from her, and I feel that that's kind of it. There's almost this sort of catharsis from Andy, be it from the relationship with his mother, or be it from his relationship with the other members of the band, and he's really letting some stuff out. He's really going for it on this one.
I mean, you know, I would imagine that Andy laughs himself, certainly in retrospect, that was his sole contribution as a writer to this landmark album. Maybe it says a lot about Andy Summers, Mike.
Maybe.
You know? Hey.
I mean, I think what's worth noting, though, and it's something that I've only really discovered throughout doing the research for our chat, that obviously while Sting had his eye on a solo career, outside of The Police, Andy was working with Kim Crimson guitarist Robert Fripp, So now, I don't know if you've heard any of their collaborations, but last night, as I was kind of pulling stuff together, I decided to have a listen to some of it, and it's really interesting stuff. It's very avant-garde, and it gives me a wider view of Andy Summers as an artist and a musician. So Mother makes a lot more sense from a musical standpoint when you hear the creativity in his work with Robert Fripp. So anyone who's not heard that before, I would thoroughly recommend digging that out, because there's some really, really fast. There's an instrumental album that they did together, which is just great album. Really cool.
I have not heard that album, and I will visit that myself. I've been listening to a bit of, you know, avant-garde stuff of late, revisiting some Frank Zappa, certainly familiar with some King Crimson. So I forget sometimes that he and Robert did some work together. So yeah, I'll check that out.
So we'll move from Andy to Stuart. Stuart's main songwriting contribution is next, and that's Miss Credenko. And he shares vocals with Sting on this track. So this seems to be the one track on the album. You'd think it might be Mother, but this seems to be the track on the album that gets the most stick from what I've seen. Consequence of Sound called the song almost unlistenable, at least in terms of lyricism. Would you say that criticism is harsh? Is it really as bad as what that quote would make out?
I think, yeah. I mean, I like the kind of poppy nature of the musical components of Miss Credenko. Clearly, Sting had no influence on those lyrics. I guess ultimately, as a guy that has been in bands and been a band member, and you know, I've been a leader of bands, but I've also been just, you know, part of a democracy. It had to be hard for both Andy and Stuart, even while the band was still together touring that album, you know, to have to get all of these commentary about their songs contributed to the album. And they just pale in comparison to the rest of it. They absolutely pale. Doesn't mean that they aren't cool pieces of art. It doesn't mean that there aren't moments of interesting melodic nature, or, you know, just taken as a whole, like Mother. You just go, wow, this is so weird. I love it. I'm going to play this in my car when I pull up at the school, you know, and people are going to think something's wrong with me. You know, you love stuff. You love stuff like that. But it had to be hard for those guys. Miss Credenko was quite listenable, you know, coming on the tail end of Mother. You know, you're still kind of shaking your head like, going, wow, what was that at the end of Mother? And then it segs into Miss Credenko. You know, it was a cool guitar figure that Andy plays on Stuart's song. You know, I don't mind it a bit. I've probably listened to Miss Credenko more than I have Mother, to tell you the truth.
So a lot of people say that if you think of songs like Miss Credenko and Mother, you know, some of these songs inside one, we've not actually discussed a single yet. So a lot of people would lead that to believe that Synchronicity is what they call a backloaded album. So all the quality and the hits are at the back end of the album. Would you agree with that? Or do you think there is, from the songs we talked about, there's still plenty in there to enjoy and to unpick?
Oh, 100%. 100%. You know, to me, the singles are on the back end of the album. I mean, I love Synchronicity too. I've already discussed that at length, which comes after Miss Credenko, but you know, from Every Breath You Take through Murder by Numbers, it's a master class, Mike, in songwriting. A master class. I don't know that there's been, what is it, 5 songs on side B? I would argue that it's possible to find 5 better songs back to back on one album in the history of rock, for sure. It would be tough. It's amazing.
Let's dig into those songs. Let's start with Synchronicity 2, which we have talked about quite a lot already. So it's our second of the title tracks on this album, which is quite a unique thing to say. We've already discussed that while there's a link between the two beyond the concept of synchronicity, Sting has often kept that particular set of cards close to his chest. He doesn't like to say a lot about what the link is. Beyond the obvious that the songs are the same name, how do you link the two songs? What do you think links the two of them?
I just always felt like, oh, that's cool that he called, you know, one is Synchronicity 1 and one is Synchronicity 2. I never really thought much about that, to tell you the truth. They were just both so great musically. You know, in the new age that we live in of playlists and streaming, I might just do that. It's like listen to the two songs back to back. And play a little game with my own thoughts as to, you know, what the connection is. If you think about it, I don't think he ever says the word synchronicity in the second song. you know, there wasn't like a standalone chorus lyric in Synchronicity 2 either, other than the section that says many miles away, there's a cottage on the shore, you know, of a dark Scottish lake, obviously like Loch Ness Monster kind of imagery. But again, I just felt like they were covering two different subject matters. You know, I wasn't able to draw a lyrical parallel in the two songs.
So Classic Rock Review called this one the best song on the album, which is a bold claim when we think about the songs that are also coming up as well. They say the musical tone follows the lyrics closely, which describe a man's working day in domestic life and compares it to the seemingly unrelated Loch Ness Monster, making this a more true title song than Synchronicity 1. So do you think, you know, we'll go back to that quote from Sting where he was saying kind of about the meaning and coincidence. Do you think that Synchronicity 2 is a strong track in terms of answering that question? Is there any meaning in coincidence?
Yes, I think so. I just love the imagery of that chorus lyric. It definitely has this impending doom. It could be more of that, you know, threat of nuclear war, climate change, et cetera, et cetera. Or it could just be, you know, the boogeyman of your own mind trying to come in through the window. And it's up to us to either let it or not let it. It's just heady stuff, Mike. It's just so heady for all of the other fluff that was on the radio and so many other bands, you know, making their contributions to pop art and pop songwriting. I mean, Sting just was head and shoulders. It was very thoughtful, very instructive. It made me feel smarter than some of my other friends that I was such a Police fan. You know what I mean? And they're listening to Ted Nugent, or they're listening to, you know what I mean? Just the best. And I was the prime age too. You know, as I mentioned earlier, I was in my first year of college when Synchronicity came out. So, you know, life was in full bloom for me and new experiences. And, you know, that was the soundtrack of it. So I'm really grateful that was the album that I picked, or the one that picked me, rather. You know, there was just no denying the impact of that record as soon as I heard it.
So I feel like as we've gone through the album, the focus of each song almost narrows. So in the beginning, we're talking about very kind of philosophical, global matters, like human existence in Walking in Your Footsteps, or religion, and oh my God, we're talking about the theory of synchronicity. But then now, and obviously this is even more apparent as the songs go on, we're focusing on kind of personal stories and like the characters in Synchronicity 2, or Sting's own personal troubles that inform the songs that are coming up later on. So it's almost like we start off with this really wide lens, but we're slowly but surely narrowing into things that are a lot more personal and a lot more individual than they were at the beginning of the album.
Yes, and you know, for me, it's funny because I spoke incorrectly a little earlier, because I forget that, you know, that it's almost like Synchronicity 2 was the start symbolically of the second half. But lyrically, it was a massive shift to come from the imagery of that track into Every Breath You Take. And like you just eloquently said, you know, the microscope is drawn tighter, and it's getting right down to, you know, the underbelly of the relationship between two people, obviously. I mean, just again, as we discussed the album as a whole, I'm so fascinated yet again that it's possible to achieve that level of storytelling, and, you know, to capture all of that. You know, I think that's the thing that we all push ourselves with as songwriters. You know, how do you make it that great? How can you be that great all the time? It's got to be a commitment, a lifestyle commitment to writing and capturing ideas. And if I could write one song as good as Synchronicity 2, Mike, that would be, you know what I mean? And you know, my own fans, they would say, oh my goodness, you've certainly done that already. But I don't think I have. And then, you know, the next track is Every Breath You Take. Oh my God. That's top of the hill, man. That's the peak. That's, to me, Every Breath You Take is up there with timeless songs like Happy Birthday, you know, or Jingle Bells, or, you know, what a song.
Absolutely. And it seems the perfect time to go into it as we're talking about it. You know, it's the most well-known song on the album. Inarguably, the biggest song, not only of the Places career, but Sting's too. And I mean, Sting's solo career is not to be sniffed at by any stretch of the imagination. He told The Independent about his experience writing the song. So he said, "I woke up in the middle of the night with that line in my head, sat down at the piano and had it written in half an hour. The words are interesting. It sounds like a comforting love song. I didn't realise at the time how sinister it is. I think I was thinking of Big Brother, surveillance and control," which I think is so interesting because obviously when he wrote it, he didn't think about the obsessive nature of the song particularly. And I think that almost comes out in the delivery of it. The protagonist in the song, I guess, maybe doesn't realize quite how obsessive and dark those lyrics are as he's singing them.
I think his delivery is part of what masks that sinister nature, because as a young man, it really didn't occur to me how dark it was until I read an article with Sting talking about it, similar to the one you just shared. You know, Sting has said many times that people would come up to him and say, "Oh, it was the theme song at our wedding. You know, it was the theme song at our prom." And he would be like, "Okay, guys, well, good luck." I mean, wow. And, you know, there's no surprise that it was written in that fashion. You just can't. It's not possible to sit down and go, "Oh, I'm going to write a song like this today." Those kind of songs only come in an inspired package. No surprise that he woke up in the middle of the night. And I've been searching for that song, Mike, of my own. You know, I do believe in kind of you come out of the REM sleep, and, you know, there are many, many times I'll hear melodies in my head either right before I drift off to sleep or right before I wake up. And I have several on my, you know, on my little voice recorder on my phone. And then I'll go back and listen to them like a week or two later, and it just sounds like mush. It's just, you know, I go, "Oh, it was terrible. Why did I think that was worth, you know, singing into my microphone?" But, you know, maybe that's the trick. You got to take it the extra step. You got to get out of bed and sit with the guitar, sit with the piano, and really give it a framework. You know, at least put a roof and some windows on it. You know, then it's more of a completed idea. But yeah, just what a song. You know, and as I mentioned earlier at the beginning of the interview, you know, the video for that song was it was equally beautiful and simple. You know, the black and white. Nothing more than shots of the individuals playing their instruments. Just, it was perfect. The song is perfect. The video is perfect. That moment in time, man, it was just perfect. The soundtrack of our life, no doubt.
And it's funny because whenever I hear that song, I always think of my first day of university. So I was sat in a lecture, which was about popular culture, and they started talking about this song. And obviously, like you, I mean, even at that age, I was about 17, 18, and I was a huge Sting fan, and I would later go on to meet him a few months later, which was just a huge thrill. But I was sitting in this lecture, and they were talking about the song and saying that, you know, a lot of people think this is a really romantic, beautiful love song, but actually, it's very dark. And it was just, I just was watching the reactions, because obviously, like you, I'd read these interviews with Sting, and I had this knowledge, but the amount of people who didn't, and when the penny dropped, and just people being like, this song that's just, as you say, just as much a part of our lives as Happy Birthday or Jingle Bells.
Yeah.
And the meaning had been completely flipped on the entire lecture theatre, who were absolutely kind of stunned that this song was very different to what they anticipated.
And you just want to believe that makes Sting happier than anything that has ever occurred to him in his whole career. He loves that he could just flip people on their head and they don't even know it. I mean, you know what I'm saying? It's like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's his version of theft, or his version of criminal activity. You know, it's abusive, man. He's just too smart for the rest of us.
So I mentioned earlier that the album was one meeting away from not happening. And this was apparently due to the initial sessions during recording for Every Breath You Take. So Hugh Padgham recalled the incident with Sound on Sound where tensions between Sting and Stewart came to a head. So he said Sting wanted Stewart to just play a very straight rhythm with no fills or anything. And that was the complete antithesis of what Stewart was about, which is what we've been saying all along, really. Stewart would say, I want to fucking put my drum part on it. And Sting would say, I don't want you to put your fucking drum part on it. I want you to put what I want you to put on it. And it would go on like that. It was really difficult. I remember calling my manager, Dennis, and telling him, I can't handle this. And I also remember quite clearly working full on for 10 days in Montserrat and having nothing on tape that was playable. So we, let alone not getting the album, we very nearly didn't get this hugely iconic song at all.
Incredible. You know, it's, again, it's one of the songs that I think we take for granted. We just take it for granted. It's so big and it's hard to imagine a world without that in it. You know, incredible to think that it, you know, it might not have happened or I wouldn't have been a part of it. Just a monumental song, man. Just, I'm running out of adjectives, Mike, to fully describe it.
Well, let's move on to King of Pain. So it's another song about the breakup of Sting's marriage. In some ways, I feel this is perhaps Sting's strongest songwriting on the entire album. And the image of a black spot on the sun being used as a metaphor for his own pain is one that's always really stuck with me. So do you think that this approach, or the more literal approach of a song like Every Breath You Take, is more effective? I guess the success of the songs may imply something different to what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, you knew from first listen that King of Pain was very, there was so much depth to it. All of the metaphors, you know, if those were the only two songs the guy ever wrote, you know, he'd be in the history books. I argue that, man. Just those two songs, Every Breath You Take, followed by King of Pain, you know, note for note, I'd put them up against anything, man. You know, and I think it spoke to me and my friends that I'm the king of pain. It was a unique phrase. It was a unique blend of words. You know what I'm saying? No one had ever said that. The king of pain. Like, what is that? Who is that? You know what I mean? Like, it's its own brand. He can make some kind of a medical ointment and call it King of Pain, you know, and it would sell millions. It's like, what a unique thing to write about. What a fascinating thing to call yourself. And for him to do it with that wordplay and the imagery is staggering.
So Sting talked about his process writing this song. He said, I conjured up symbols of pain and related them to my soul. A black spot on the sun struck me as being a very painful image, and I felt that this was my soul up there on the sun. It's just projecting your state into the world of symbolism, which is what poetry is all about, really, which I think is just a really nice way of putting it. And it's funny because when I think particularly of Sting's solo career, as much as a songwriter, I do kind of think of him as a poet. So to kind of talk about what poetry is just a really nice way of explaining his process.
Yeah, and you want to think he probably, you do get a sense maybe that he wrote these lyrics before the music. You know, a lot of times, any songwriter, you know, you start with a melody first. I'd be fascinated to know what came first in this instance, if it was the melody or if it were, you know, the lyrics, because it's absolutely poetry. There's no question about it.
So in some ways, I feel like this, like earlier tracks on the album we talked about, this could very easily sit on a Sting solo album as well. And we've talked about this album being a bridge of sorts between The Police and Sting's solo career. Sputnik Music identify that on King of Pain and our next track, Wrapped Around Your Finger, that both songs are accompanied by moody synth parts with strong choruses. So as Sting really found his formula for creating hit songs on Synchronicity, would you agree that we're starting to see what we'd come to expect of Sting in the coming years?
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that the synthesizer was a huge component of songs, you know, Nothing But the Sun, Dream of the Blue Turtle, Ten Summoner's Tales. I mean, he never hesitated to sit down at the piano or the synth, you know, to frame his songs, maybe more so than he had on the earlier Police record. So, I agree with that.
So we'll move on to Wrapped Around Your Finger. So like our previous two songs, it's another song very specific to Sting's life at that time. So he said in the past that all three songs were about his life. How do you think that Wrapped Around Your Finger stands out from Every Breath You Take and King of Pain, bearing in mind that they all, in some way, share the same inspiration?
for me, Wrapped Around Your Finger was the most beautiful love song of all of them, maybe of any he's ever done. Certainly with the Police. I'm really partial to his song Fortress Around Your Heart from his solo career. But Wrapped Around Your Finger, for me, especially when I became a father of a daughter, you know, that's a term is probably used around the world, you know, oh, she's got you wrapped around her finger. I think it was clever. It was thing to take this kind of timeless idea and make a love song out of it.
So for me personally, I feel like that while all three songs are sharing that same subject matter, as we go on, they're becoming less literal and more poetic. So you were talking about kind of some of the language that he used. Wrapped Around Your Finger contains references to Greek mythology and Faust, which is about as far away as we can get from like the simple but effective wake up in the middle of the night and write down what you feel lyrics of Every Breath You Take. They're very different songs in that sense.
Yeah, just incredibly heady stuff. I mean, who name another writer that could put the word alabaster into a song lyric, you know?
Yeah.
You know, to this day, when I hear that line, it makes me laugh. He's just like, wow, another point for you, Sting. Well played.
So we talked about the music video for Every Breath You Take. I think the music video for this one is particularly memorable as the sections of it where Sting is running around a maze of candlesticks. So just before we move on to the last couple of songs on the album, I have a quote from Andy about that video, and it does give some insight as to just what band relations were like at that point. So he said, "I never much liked the idea for Wrapped Around Your Finger. I was kind of pissed off about that one. I've never been much of a fan of that song, actually. Sting got to shoot his part last in that video and made a meal of knocking all the candles out. Fuck him. Have you seen the video?"
He said that. He said...
Yeah, so have you seen that one?
Oh, totally. Absolutely, man. No, and it is a bit of a fuck you, I think, when Sting himself, you know, he's got, I think he had sunglasses on in it, you know, and he's moving around but yeah, right then at the end when he just starts taking out all the candles knocks them all down. It's again, man, he's just such a brilliant punk in his own way, you know, it's. Mm-hmm.
To be fair though, it's like at the minute, obviously last year you released an album with Shaggy, and I know that loads of people are getting really like up in arms about that. And I feel like when you're talking about kind of punk, like what is more punk than doing an album with Shaggy that'll just rile everybody up? And to be fair, I listened to it. It's not a bad album at all. It really isn't.
No, and look, man, let's be honest. To me, the definition of being a punk is doing whatever the hell you want to.
Exactly, exactly.
And he's always done that. Always. Mm-hmm. It's inspiring.
So we'll move on to Tea in the Sahara. So now, as I recall, you said that you had the album on cassette initially. Was that correct?
Yes, I did.
So depending on what format you listen to Synchronicity, Tea in the Sahara, for some people, was the final song on the album. So if you had the vinyl, the LP version, Tea in the Sahara closes the album. But if you own the album on cassette or CD, which... I mean, CD was a very new medium at the time. There is actually a track after this, which is Murder by Numbers, which we'll talk about in a minute. So I guess before we go forward, obviously you'd said that you had the cassette of that. Do you feel that Tea in the Sahara would be kind of an appropriate ending to the album? Or do you think that Murder by Numbers needs to be there for you?
Well, I think for me, as you know, my taste definitely leaned a bit more rock, I think, than most of the Police fans around the world. You know, because as I was obsessed with Synchronicity, you know, the following year I was obsessed with Van Halen's album 1984, you know, just as intensely. So I always loved that Murder by Numbers was some tempo to end the cassette with, you know, and of course later I did get it on CD. No, Tea in Sahara was, it was really sexy, you know, that melody and the dynamic, again, the bass guitar. The bass just sounds so great on that song. Very atmospheric. You know, I have definitely put Tea in the Sahara on many a playlist of either just chill music or romantic music. You know, it's a beautiful song, man. Beautiful lyric. I know it made an impression on my wife when we were just dating, you know, that was one of the first albums I pulled out and would play that song. It's just great, man. It's beautiful.
So, I mean, Tea in the Sahara was based on a novel by Paul Bowles called The Sheltering Sky that Sting really enjoyed. It's a big favourite of the band. So Sting's professed his love for this song a few times, and even Stewart has said that it's his favourite song on Synchronicity. Would you go as far as to say that it is the best song on the album, or do you think that maybe, I know that you've talked a lot about Synchronicity too, would you say maybe that for you is more the highlight?
Yeah, I mean, again, man, I think because of my, you know, my rock leanings, I would pick Synchronicity 2 above that. But, you know, also King of Pain, just a masterclass songwriting, you know. But Tea in Sahara is absolutely a highlight. No question about it. Again, just the cement that's the B-side or side two was the coup de grace. It was the, you know, what an achievement, what an accomplishment.
So we'll move on to our final track, Murder by Numbers. As I said, this isn't on many vinyl pressings of the album, and from what I can gather, some reissues have it on, some don't, but obviously the cassette and the CD version of Synchronicity do include this song. Do you think that Synchronicity would be a lesser album without it? Do you think that it feels wrong to imagine the album without this song on it?
I do not. I think it would be a great album even without that song. For me personally, Murder by Numbers just happens to be one of my favorite Police songs, mostly because of the lyric, that chord progression, like quintessential Andy Summers with the dissonant voicings, you know, and whatever those chords are, man, it's just brilliance. It's definitely one of those songs I've always wanted to take some time and sit down and try to figure out on the guitar. You know, it sounds like there was some kind of synthesized, either a foot pedal or some digital technology that he was running the guitar through to create the sound that it did. You know, I don't think it surprised any of us to hear Sting sing a lyric about murder being easy. You know, no problem. It's not that hard to murder someone and get away with it. Yeah, what a concept. Another message to the guys in the band. We'll never know, will we?
I hadn't even thought of it like that. So Stewart spoke to Sound Vapors about the immediacy of the way they recorded this album, and he said that it was nowhere more evident than Murder by Numbers. So I've got a quote here. He said, "We're sitting at the dinner table, and Andy's plunking on his guitar with his Sophisto jazz chords, and Sting loves that shit. He pulls out his book, and he's got a lyric for that, and they're sort of working it out at the table there. Shit, so let's do one. So they walk downstairs, and the drums are only 20 feet away, and I walk over to them. I then start to figure out that rhythm. I'm still playing that by the time they get down to the recording room." Bear in mind what we were saying earlier, that they're all in separate rooms. "So I'm already playing when they plug in their amps, and Hugh switches on the tape machine to record, and it's already in progress. They pick it up and just lay the tune down one time, and that's the record. We didn't even run it through one time. That was it. The first time it was ever attempted, that was the recording."
Mind blowing. I did not know that. Unbelievable. Wow.
I mean, the fact that they could pull that together so quickly. But again, we've talked so much about how talented these guys are. In some ways, maybe it should be no surprise.
Well, you know what, Mike? I feel like that's the perfect note to end not only the album, but to, you know, to come to the conclusion of our time together discussing the record. It is the perfect ending. I prefer the album ending with Murder by Numbers.
It's an album that signaled the Police as the biggest band in the world, but it would also ultimately be their last. Albumism.com summed things up perfectly while marking Synchronicity's 35th anniversary. In its purest album form, Synchronicity is the Police in the prime of their powers, presenting well-crafted tune after tune for our listening pleasure. It was the album that further skyrocketed them into the musical stratosphere, garnered them Grammy Awards and chart-topping success, and ultimately spelt their end. But if a band is going to go out, you'd be hard-fought to find a better album to go out on. With that in mind, why does Synchronicity stand the test of time for you?
This answer may be underwhelming, but it's just about the songs. The songs are so monumental. To me, I mean, I don't know, maybe there are more perfect albums top to bottom by other bands, you know, that didn't have Mother or Miss Credenko on it, you know. But again, I just think if there was some band, a new band in existence right now, and they came out with songs on the caliber of Tea in the Sahara, Synchronicity 2, King of Pain, I think the band would be very, very successful. And you know what? There probably are some bands like that. I'm just not aware of who they are because, you know, I'm an older music fan now. You know, as we all do, we gravitate toward the music of our own youth and development. But it's just an incredible accomplishment. And I again, man, to me, it's all about the songs and the level of quality of them.
And finally, why is Synchronicity your classic album? And why should people check it out if they haven't already?
For anyone that has any interest in being in a band, the interplay between those three guys on those 10 or 11 songs, depending on the version that you have, is as good as it gets. If you fancy an interest in songwriting, everything you need is right there on that album. But I wanted to share with you, Mike, as we close, and this kind of answers this last question that you just asked about why it's my classic album. I myself had my own interaction with Sting back in 2000, and I think it was 2010. In 2010, I had the mind-blowing experience of playing guitar in a one-time band in Las Vegas for a big television radio show extravaganza. It's called the iHeart Radio Festival. Steven Tyler from Aerosmith was the singer, Jeff Beck on lead guitar, and for one song, which was Sweet Emotion by Aerosmith, the bass player was one Gordon Sumner. My longtime friend Marty Fredrickson played drums, and he was the one, he and Steven were mates, and he was the one commissioned to put the rest of the band together. So there was a keyboard player, and Marty called me to play the second guitar. So I had a chance to work with Sting. We had a rehearsal, and then the concert the next day. You know, he just, like I say, it was just one song that he played on. There is a video on YouTube, so you can pull it up at your leisure. Yeah, if you just type in Steven Tyler, Jeff Beck, Sting, there's only one time those three guys were in the same room together ever. and I was standing there with him. But the rehearsal was so great because typical Sting, he was the first guy there. I mean, I was there because I was setting up some of the gear and making sure everything was working, but Sting was the first guy to arrive. And he came straight over to me, introduced himself, and grabbed his bass and said, "Hey, can we go over a couple of things? I want to make sure I've got this particular part right," or, you know, whatever. We just had the best experience. And Trudy was with him. You know, the performance the next night was fantastic. You know, we opened the show. I mean, the lineup that night, like Lady Gaga played. I think Coldplay was there. You know, it was a big deal, man. It was a lot of different artists from all different genres. But at the close of the night, I had gone back to the dressing room to get my bag, you know, to head back to the hotel. And as I was walking down the hallway, Sting and Trudy were coming the opposite direction. And he set down his bag and he hugged me and he said, "Damon, I want to thank you." He goes, "You were my wingman for the entire length of my heavy metal career." And if that weren't enough, Trudy came over. She kissed me on the cheek. She said, "Damon, thank you for looking out for Sting. He told me that he really relied on you to get him through all that." So, you know, I mean, my wife was with me. I mean, we were just, we could barely talk. You know, our jaws were just on the floor, but we all four had a big laugh, and we, you know, we said, "Thank you. We won't ever forget this experience." So what a highlight for me and my wife, you know, for our life. So, who knows, man, who knows what the future holds, but, Sting and the Police, they occupy a giant piece of real estate in my musical soul, without a doubt. So thank you for this opportunity to talk about this great record, Mike.
So that's a huge, huge thanks to Damon Johnson for taking time out to chat with me about his chosen classic album, Synchronicity, by The Police. And, you know, I feel like I said this at the end of every episode, this was one of my favourites. I really enjoyed it. It was great to talk to Damon. And it was funny, when I was promoting this episode, people were commenting underneath like, "Oh, we love Damon so much. We can't wait to hear it. We just love to hear him talk about stuff." So I hope that you enjoyed it as much as I did. The only frustration that I have is that at the beginning of our chat, the first 10, 15 minutes or so, there were a few little technical difficulties, and I did have to leave a couple of bits out. So he talked about his time in Brother Kane and how they performed Synchronicity 2 on some occasions. And it was so fascinating to listen to. But then when I listened back to it,
I'd had some technical difficulties on the Skype call, and unfortunately that part of it was unsalvageable. So I'd like to apologise to Damon, because, you know, I would love to have been able to let everyone hear that. And to apologise to everyone else that we couldn't play that. But I'd like to think that we did Synchronicity justice. You know, it is a truly classic album, more than worthy of its place on the podcast. And, you know, Damon's taste in music is pretty awesome, because, you know, there are another couple of albums that we said towards the end, like, yeah, let's do this again sometime. You know, so hopefully Damon will come back someday and we'll pick up on some of these other albums that that he are just a huge part of his evolution as a musician. So, you know, I hope you enjoyed my chat with Damon. His latest album, Memoirs of an Uprising, is out now on Double Dragon Records. And it's a great album. It's awesome. You know, if you're a fan of Damon, you know what to expect. It's just a great album. Absolutely go and get it. It's mint. And just like that, we're at the end of another episode of My Classic Album. Thank you so much for joining me, as always. My special guest in a couple of weeks' time will be Hannah Wickland, and she has chosen Damn the Torpedoes, the breakthrough album by Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. So we're going to be giving it the My Classic Album treatment in a couple of weeks. So join me and Hannah for that on the 15th of June. I will see you then. Cheers!